very delighted that you can give us an outlook what the results will be of the US election.
The situation is so crazy. You have to stop for a second to understand why no one is talking about the third candidate, who currently is stronger than Obama was at a similar time in the race, and that is Robert Kennedy. And this is partly because both the Democrats and Republicans are in denial and hoping that he just goes away, but he seems to completely own the under 35-year-old vote and almost the whole under 45-year-old vote. And when he's exposed to the older crowd, the boomers, his conversion rate is very high. It's also because he has had a long career of suing the U.S. government and the pharmaceutical companies over health-related issues. And so he has said, I'm going to make pharmaceutical advertising on television illegal, which it is in every country in the world except for the U.S. and New Zealand. So obviously, this is a huge problem for all the major news networks who depend on pharma advertising revenues. It's existential for CNN, CNBC, and therefore they also are trying to pretend this is not happening and not reporting and hoping it will go away. But it isn't going away. And so even though nobody in the rest of the world seems to have heard about this third candidate, I am suggesting he will play the most pivotal role in this election. Now, he may not win outright. It's very hard for him to win outright. But in the US, you can reach a situation where neither Biden nor Trump can win the 270 votes the Constitution requires. If that happens, then we have what they call a contingent election, which means the House of Representatives will decide and the Senate will decide the vice president. The last time we saw that happen was in the early 1800s. So everyone will have a meltdown when we get to that point.
And you have to explain to the Europeans, because we only know about Trump and Biden, and we always think it's just it's a competition between the two. What does it actually mean if both of them, let's say, have 250 votes each?
So they have to get, one of them has to get 270 electoral college votes. If they can't, if they only get 269, then the whole process moves to a contingent election, which means the new House of Representatives, not the existing one, but the new one. So we'll have to wait until January when they're all sworn in. So there'll be a big gap between the election and the results. Well, that alone is an issue the markets will have to manage. But the new House will then decide, and it's not based on left or right. It's based on a negotiation. So, for example, if we get to that point, the borderline states, which only voted for President Biden by, let's say, 0.2%, like Wisconsin or Georgia, any candidate can go to that state and say, listen, forget left or right. You have these three issues that matter to you. I will deliver those three issues. Now, the only person of the three of them, Biden, Trump, and Kennedy, that can do that negotiation is Kennedy, partly because he is in the middle. He's not on the left and he's not on the right. He's kind of a Clinton-style Democrat, meaning he's pro-business, but also pro-social issues and social privacy. You can't use the traditional metric of, well, it's just how many states are red and how many states are blue. It'll be a negotiated deal, kind of coalition style, you know, that the Europeans are so familiar with. But this is new for us Americans.
Well, it's 200 years ago that happened.
That last happened, exactly.
Now, let's talk about the New World Order. Mm. So there's China, of course, competing with the U.S., and the U.S. has the only remaining superpower, world power so far, but China really is kind of getting on and trying to be, again, like they were 350 years ago, or 500 years ago, whatever you want to call it. They used to be the world number one power. What is your outlook on the New World Order?
So Russia and China have aligned with Iran and North Korea. And the U.S. is, of course, aligned with NATO and some other friends like Japan, for example. And what's interesting is the Chinese-Russian side are very well aware that they cannot win in a traditional military conflict with the United States. So that is not actually their strategy, even though they have initiated the war in Ukraine, they have, you know, they threatened to do something around Taiwan. But I think the actual strategy is designed to force the United States to be on high alert. So we send aircraft carriers into the Mediterranean and the Red Sea and into the Pacific, and we send troops into certain critical locations. The thing is, this is hugely expensive. So their view is, we're going to bleed you dry of cash. In America, I don't think a few people in the strategic security community have really recognized that this is the strategy. But most people are still stuck in the, well, we can win any fight. Well, that's true, but that's not what's going to happen, because they know they're going to lose in a traditional fight. So this is a kind of a financial battlefield. You know, they say that on a battlefield, the leading cause of death is bleeding out. This is a financial battlefield where the strategy is to bleed you financially. So that's a different way of thinking about things. Well, here's the crazy part, is that when you say to Americans that we spend more than we earn and we depend on China to make the ends meet by buying our bonds, you know, that we borrow from China, most Americans will say, that's ridiculous. I don't know anybody borrowing any money from the Chinese. And I've had that from senators and congressmen, right? Because they don't really understand what the current account deficit is technically. The good news for America is that when all this confrontation started, everybody was afraid that the Chinese would start selling U.S. government bonds, and then interest rates would go up and it would cause a big problem in the world economy. Actually, U.S. pension funds have bought everything. So we've had a smooth transition, actually. China still owns a fair amount, and they can sell from time to time, but it's not actually in their interests to lose money on that too, especially when their economy is in absolutely terrible shape right now. I think much worse than most people realize. And so here's another piece of the puzzle. Within China, the old Shanghai crowd, the Deng Xiaoping community, the old Deng Xiaoping community is doing a resurgence is happening. They are going, you know what? Xi Jinping keeps talking about war. War in Ukraine, war over Taiwan. We'd like to go back to making money again. We would like to go back to a world where we can get along with the United States. So I think the pressure on Xi Jinping is intensifying. And I won't be surprised if we wake up one morning and we just find he's not in charge anymore. And if we get a deal on Ukraine, which I think we're going to do, we can talk about that, that probability rises dramatically.
What does it actually mean for the world order? Will the U.S. maintain its position as the number one country in the world, including their allies probably, but of course the U.S. wants to remain the number one in the world, yeah. Or will China take over, and if yes, in what respect?
Well, so this is such an interesting question, because I have to say, on how do we measure this? So I think the U.S., when it comes to innovation, is unbeatable. And everyone says, well, but China is innovating so much now. And I say, well, are they? They have a system where no one can say, I failed. No one can say, well, we tried, but it doesn't work. And they have to say everything's wonderful. Otherwise, they get penalized. And I think this actually hurts innovation. They can throw a lot of money at things, but if you want real technological innovation, the United States is still the epicenter of that. Is China the biggest market in the world? Well, it was, but now that it's having domestic economic problems, not necessarily so attractive. And the rest of the world has moved the supply chains so that they're interested in baking things in the West and buying things that are Western made. So I think the real bottom line is China's economy is going to get better over time. It's going to be bigger over time. But the U.S. economy is also getting bigger and better. So is that good for the world? Actually, yes. Both will be better off in the future than they are today.
So what about Europe? Europeans are rather concerned that now they're kind of squashed,
yes,
squashed in between the two superpowers. What is your opinion on that?
I do think it's not just Europe, Asia too. Everybody's being asked the question by both the Americans and the Chinese, whose side are you on? And it's a terrible question. We shouldn't have to be choosing sides. And so maybe the real role in Europe is try to get us back to a place where it's not one or the other, but a dialogue can be created. And this is a very sensitive issue in Europe. The key problem, of course, is Ukraine right now. And interestingly, I'm finding Europeans are very nervous about the idea that the U.S. might cut a deal with the Russians. Whereas Americans are generally feeling, let's cut a deal. Like, why are we at war? Let's end this war by coming to some arrangement. And so the decision about what's the right way to go is kind of up in the air. I think in the end, look, it's the U.S. and China that are going to make that decision. And that also sounds strange because people are like, wait, what does China have to do with Ukraine? But the reality is that Ukraine happened because President Putin wanted that, but he checked in with the Chinese and they gave a green light. And they've continued with the green light up until the threat of nuclear weapons. The moment President Putin threatened nuclear weapons, Xi Jinping said, constructive talks, truce, let's not go there. And that has allowed the U.S. and China to begin a dialogue, albeit a stressful one, about how do we keep the world away from that terrible outcome. And I think that we will succeed in that. But President Putin's being very aggressive right now. And as you know, as we speak, he is testing the short-range tactical nuclear weapons. And so everyone is very, very nervous right now.
So the other part that you mentioned, it might be a very, very important aspect of world leadership is space.
Yes.
How would you ascribe to somebody who's never thought about that space is very, very important in the future? How would you describe the importance of that?
So most people are asking, why are we spending all this money on the space race? Don't we have enough problems here on Earth? And isn't it just a bunch of billionaires joyriding? And the answer is no. Space is now the most important military strategic domain of Earth. And the important thing to understand is Ukraine is not a ground war. It is a space war. All wars now are space wars because they all depend on satellites. So when the Chinese said to Elon Musk, we're going to designate Starlink, which is the satellite company that the Ukrainians have been relying on, we're going to designate this as a military company. You are a military participant in a war. And Elon said, no, I'm just a commercial guy. I'm running a business. And by the way, I want to be friendly to China because they're supporting Tesla, right? So he turned the bandwidth down on Ukraine, which meant they could not execute the offensive operations to the degree they had been before. So they were screaming. The point is, all of these military operations on the ground totally depend on space. And the Pentagon has recently said the most important warfighting domain today is space. Now, there's another set of reasons as well, which is we're in a real space race between the superpowers. It's the US, China, Russia, but it's also Japan and Turkey and India. And so why is everybody racing? The answer is abundance, because it looks like we can achieve unlimited energy, unlimited resources, and unlimited internet connectivity from physical presence in space.